Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm broadcasting from a hotel room in New Haven, Connecticut. A pleasant hotel this is. It is called The Blake, and the rooms are nice. There's a whole kitchen here. Poor Dino, man. Dino saw this room, and he's like, that's all I need, man. I could live in that room. It's perfect. And so I don't know. I might leave him here, and he might live here. I'm not clear on that, but I'll see in a few minutes when we're supposed to leave. Hey, it could happen. Weirder things have happened. We have one more gig here. By tomorrow, when you hear this, I will be flying home, and we will have done it. But I will say this. This has been a great and emotional little journey that I've embarked on here with my buddy Dean Del Rey. Juliet Lewis is on the show today. She's in this Facebook Watch mystery series, Sacred Lies, The Singing Bones. It's in its second season, and it's now streaming. She's also going to be on this Bon Scott tribute that Dean's doing. We've done a couple of these where a bunch of us get together and jam and play the music. And that's March 10th at the Avalon in Hollywood. So that's going to happen. You can go to, I guess, deandelrey.com to get tickets, but she's going to be involved with that. She sings the rock music. But anyways, at the end of last year, we marked 10 years of doing WTF, and we thought it would be cool to have some merch that celebrates 10 years of being here. So we got together with the artist Johnny Jones, who did the amazing album cover for our Record Store Day release. Johnny went to work on this and came up with the Decades of Domination collection. You can see the designs on our Twitter and Facebook and Instagram pages or at podswag.com/merch. You really got to see these designs to appreciate them. But the best I can describe them is that they include laser cats, giant tentacles, UFOs, and global annihilation. How's that? And you can get the Decade of Domination designs on a signed limited edition poster, glow-in-the-dark t-shirt, and something we've never offered before, a writing set, which includes an embossed notebook, a WTF pen, and a gift box. We've got some enamel pins coming in the near future as well. So come and celebrate a decade of domination with us. We've all earned it, God knows. Go to podswag.com/WTF or just go to WTFpod.com and click on the merch link. Okay? So as I was rambling there about this journey, there was something about the end of this tour, the end of this material, and coming back to this part of the country that just, I don't know, I was really looking forward to being in New England in the winter. I know that sounds crazy. I didn't know whether or not it would be snowing or there'd be snow everywhere or it would be a problem. You know, I rented a small SUV just in case. But this is the region I started in. And these are the gigs that I used to do when I was coming up. Not even coming up, at the very beginning, driving around these highways, around these states, specifically Maine, Connecticut, Rhode Island, not Huntington, New York. I never went out on the island that much. So, you know, kind of flying into Maine and landing in Portland and just feeling that brisk cold and just, you know, having a season, having, you know, bringing my warm clothes, layering up and getting ready to do these shows and just looking forward to eating seafood and driving along, you know, I-95 and just looking at that scenery in the winter, those bare trees, the sort of grayness of it all, the sort of just the hours I spent driving into mysterious places, not knowing what the gig would be like, where it would be, how it would be set up, who would come at any sort of random pub or bar and grill or disco or bowling alley where the subcontractor had set up the comedy night. and just that weird anticipation, smoking Marlboro cigarettes, you know, over one after the other, just driving up, looking at my notes in one of my dad's old cars, one of the Honda Accord LXs that I inherited from him, driving up, and sometimes the heater not working, sometimes driving all the way up from New York to Maine. I mean, I did a show in Machias, Maine, which I think is the furthest point east in this country, to open for an X-rated hypnotist when I was starting out, Frank Santos. And I just kind of noticed as we creeped up the coast how the gene pool got tighter and things got weirder. And I tell you, man, there's something about, I guess, full circle, about closure, nostalgia. I don't know what, but we're, you know, I'm just kind of let go of a lot of my anxiety and engaged in this process, you know, to do these shows. And it's been pretty fucking great. It's really been pretty great. But the other element of, you know, of what's happening for me is that I'm letting go of this material. I'm letting go of about an hour and 15 minutes of material because it will be on Netflix on March 10th. And that's the end of it. And it is a sort of, it's got a dark through line. I don't think it's cynical. I think it's exciting. It deals with a lot of what we're going through now with a certain amount of hopelessness and a feeling of powerlessness and pushing back against that. And now, and how we do it as people. But maybe I'm reading too much into it. It's very exciting that, you know, out of Nevada, the sort of, now the national dialogue around politics is going to be actually progressive, and you know, class issues are going to really come to the fore. It's a, you know, I don't know how everything's going to fall out or how everything's going to play out, but it's a very exciting time. I don't know if I'm hopeful per se, but I'm excited. But here's an email from somebody that moved me, because I do get down on myself about, sometimes about the type of material I'm doing or what I'm putting people through or how they respond to it, because I don't really know. I don't know. I move this stuff through my heart and through my mind and through my hands and through the pen, and I don't know. It's what I have to do. So I don't really know how it lands all the time. And after doing it more and more and sort of adding to this conversation that I've created over the last couple of years, I get excited about it, but it's heavy, man. So I got this email from someone named Orla, subject line, Providence Columbus Theater feedback, totally amazeballs, go Jews. My man, wow, longtime fan. What an incredible show last night. Part sarcasm, part death, part life, part after death, part Armageddon, part abstract introspection, part intellectual, part imaginative. I want you to know your closing joke is as funny as you think it is. I feel like you were suspended in disbelief as each part unfolded. It was brilliant, and the clarity of its deeper meaning was so refreshing to hear. What a relief there are people out there who see this for what it is. Authoritarianism on the rise. We are at the fucking end of times, and end game scenarios are worth contemplating. Dig it. I say dig it. It was so incredible to hear a rational person speaking with such charisma and well-thought-out rhetoric. And you're nice. It really made me think of ancient citizens just discussing worthwhile topics in public spaces like Socrates and Plato. That's my answer to your question at the start of the show, when you were like stretching your sciatica and then you just kind of exposed your flesh and bone with the statement, "What do I know really?" Well, I'll tell you what you know, man. You know what the fuck is up. You have a unique perspective founded in reason and facts, and your message resonates. Your work and the things you say are an echo in this era for reason and goodness. You have the power to deliver messages to a theater filled with people and millions more each day. More than that, you are the mark of an era. Not so much a leader as more of a spokesperson for people everywhere that are just like, what the fuck? And it's just so nice to hear logical things being said out loud, and the occasional joke doesn't hurt. And you examine life out loud as it unfolds, and people need to do that more. So thanks. All the very best, Orla. P.S. Socrates was actually a Jew. Is that true? Oh, I don't want to forget this, because this was a pretty important. We're driving down to Providence, and we're doing a live Instagram thing, and someone on my Twitter says you got to go to Empire Guitars. And I don't go to a lot of guitar shops. I get overwhelmed. I get tired. I get bored. But we decided, we went online on the phone to look at what they had, and it was a real deal place. They had real vintage shit. And I don't know, man. I just saw this Les Paul Jr. They had several Les Paul Juniors from the 50s and 60s. One double cutaway Les Paul Jr. with the single P90. I don't know much about guitars, but I know I like that sound. And I don't know, man. The rest was sort of like, I put it up on my Instagram. Dean shot it. You can see the moment where I'm just like, I love this thing. I fall in love with a guitar right there on camera. And I bought it, and they're shipping it out to me. It's my first vintage electric guitar purchase. It was completely reasonable. It was not like gross in any way, and in terms of cost. And I can't wait. It was so exciting. So that happened on this trip as well. I fell in love with a guitar and married it. And I'm hoping, you know, that it's weird that we both had to be apart for a few days, but I hope when we finally come back together, we've made the right decision and the honeymoon is lovely. You will hear it. I will play it for you. So that was exciting. That was an exciting part of this trip. And now we were here in New Haven last night. Great. Great show at the College Street Theater. Great food yesterday. I'm going to die, but I'll die happy, I guess. I got to get it together here. I got to drive down to Huntington, New York, which should be exciting. One more show, and then I will grieve the loss of this chunk of material, and it will exist as it did the night that I recorded the special in October in Los Angeles forever. New bits are evolving. There's about a half hour to 40 minutes of new material that's happening, and so I'm on my way. I guess I'm not going to quit doing comedy just yet. So I guess as we head into the interview here, I just want to thank the people of Cleveland, Grand Rapids, Milwaukee, Tampa, Orlando, Portland, Maine, Providence, New Haven, and most likely, I'll let you know on Thursday, Huntington, New York, for coming out to this winter leg of this show, of this tour, the last legs of it. It's really been a tremendous good time. I've had a good time, and I'm happy to report that Sam Sylvia for this season of GLOW will be the paunchy guy he was the first two seasons, as opposed to the emaciated man he was the third season. All right, so Juliette Lewis and I talk back at the new studio at the house, and she, as I said before, is in the Facebook Watch mystery series Sacred Lies, The Singing Bones. Season 2 is now streaming. She'll also be singing on March 10th at the Bon Scott tribute with hopefully me, if I'm not shooting, and an all-star band for Dean Del Rey's Bon Scott tribute. You can go to deandelrey.com for tickets to that. But this is me talking to the amazing Juliette Lewis, who I love, who everyone loves. Curious person, unique person, a one of a kind.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
You come from a big family.
So I always describe, you would need a diagram.
Oh, really? Like that?
Well, it's simply put, both my parents were married several times.
Oh, right.
So my mom married 3, my dad married 4. When you say this out loud, it sounds insane, but yeah. It's what I know. But I grew up with an older brother, and I grew up with a younger sister, and then I have half brothers and sisters.
So the more immediate ones you have like a deeper relationship with, basically, or you're pretty close to all of them?
It's funny because in my older years, I'm extremely close with
the half ones,
different half ones, and you know, with
that must be kind of exciting. It's almost like finding like you have this genetic sibling that you didn't know about, but not exactly like that. But to have this, maybe people who are really directly related to you, but you just never got that close, and all
you
of a
never
sudden,
got that, and then you learn about each other, and you're like, wow, I really like you. Like one of my brothers, Beau, who lives in New Orleans, he's he's just one of my heroes. He was the one. I don't think he would mind me saying this, but he was the one. You know, 15 plus years ago, we always thought we'd get the call that going to be here.
Right.
And he turned his life around, I think 16 years ago now. He's sober. He helps people. And yeah, he's got
so he's sober. He's doing the thing.
Doing the thing. Walking the walk. Just helping. And he's my hero because there's no type of person or personality he can't sort of jive with commune with.
Because he's open.
Yes.
And he's been through it.
He's been through it. And actually, he, of course, is more helpful, you know, the underdog or...
Oh, yeah.
I might lose my words today because every time when I have to do an interview, because there's like a little stress to form sentences correctly.
No, there's not.
And then my mind will play a trick and go, I'm going to remove
words.
This adjective that you always use.
Yeah.
All right.
But wait, you're sober too, right?
I'm not AA sober.
Right.
No, but I'm, as far as not, I don't do drugs.
Right.
Like in this way, or when I was a kid. I quit all street drugs when I was 22.
Mm.
So, and I didn't.
Street drugs. I wonder what makes that list. Weed. You still smoke weed?
Even weed? No. I don't. Oh, even though it's legal now, I can't. And yeah. I was a crazy weed head when I was a teenager. I can't do it.
Yeah. So you just like drink occasionally is what you're saying.
Yes.
Right. But you don't find yourself in trouble with it.
I find, not alcohol. That was the one thing I never, I get it. My trouble spots are my own mind being doom and gloom and
me too dread
with as you're getting older, you know, I have the days where we're all gonna die. Point, you know,
what's
and you're
point?
Like, well,
I'm gonna eat this or whatever the fuck you're rationalizing.
Well, even I'm saying even to invest in one's getting out of bed.
What's the point?
That stuff.
Yeah.
That's before you're
right.
So I have to be really mindful of
vigilant.
Yeah.
Against anxiety and depression.
Yes.
Hmm. Like I knew people who were I dated a woman who was borderline personality. And that's one of these ones where it's completely caused. It's a caused thing.
Okay.
You know, it's like depression can be biological. Alcoholism can go for generations. But, you know, borderline is like that someone bailed and left that person hanging. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It is wild.
What I want to say, because we just dove off the fucking deep end.
We don't
God. Oh my God. And we didn't even say, how's your day today?
How was your day?
Oh, it was rough.
It was?
Well, no, because, you know, some days you don't want to talk about yourself.
Today was one of those days?
Yes.
Is there a day?
Or you don't want to be, I don't want to be me. Can we take a vacation from it a second?
Or you don't want to do anything?
Yeah. My problem is either I work, and I have to be invested and focused. That's why characters and being invested in that way and focus, because I really can chew on something, you know, a dramatic story.
Lose yourself a bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I'm not doing that, that's the navigation, the life. But no, today's fine.
I always get very anxious about doing anything, you know, whether it's talking to people that come over or having to show up for shit. Yeah. Like I get, and I used to think a lot of my negativity and the dread is just, it's just anxiety.
Yeah.
It's just fucking anxiety.
Yeah.
And that's the way my brain deals with it. Like, there's no way to get out from under it. So I just resign it to like, oh, it's going to be tough. It's going to be bad. It's going to be, you know, whatever.
And isn't it the thing, because I've had a week, I have to do promotion stuff, where there's a thing of what do you force yourself, or even, seeing a friend, what do you force yourself to do? Because you know, in the end, there is connectivity.
Yeah.
It does get you out of yourself. And what do you go, no, I'm not, today's not the day.
Right.
You know, work stuff, I don't have that luxury.
I force myself.
Be a team player. Yeah, force ourselves.
But the promotion thing, you know how it goes, like, because I've dealt with that too. And this is, it's hard to do it in this particular format. But you figure out a few things you say.
Yeah.
And you go do the thing. And they all seem happy. No one's like, I don't know.
Oh, no, they're lovely. Yeah. Oh, wait, can I just say, because we got off into the hemming and hawing, I've been wanting to meet you for a very long time.
I feel that. I felt that that was true.
Yes.
It's a while ago, right?
We were supposed to meet several times. I wanted to do your show.
Yeah.
Just didn't work out scheduling wise.
Right.
But, oh, here's the big takeaway in our modern day world and being older and experienced, is you realize even when you're doing all that showbiz shit and you got to sit down, you know, people don't know at home the or in their cars, wherever
the junket
you are,
business,
where you're talking to someone every 5 minutes, a new face.
Yeah.
Hi, we're so-and-so from Texas, blah, blah, blah. And they talk to you. When you realize everybody's doing a job that day, like you don't know what their kid is sick or their dad's in the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, you're not the only one. So once you realize you guys are kind of on the same side as human beings, that's a big shift from when you're a total egocentric child or
self-centered.
Yes.
That's like you just provided people with an empathy tool.
Okay.
Right? Because that's what happens. Like a lot of times, especially when you're a public personality and you get like 10 emails about 10 different things of people wanting something from you, because you've gotten 10, none of those people know you've gotten 10.
Yes.
But you just lump them all together into this one sort of like, don't they know I want to have a life?
Yes.
That I don't have all the time. And it's you can't separate it sometimes because it's all coming at you at once.
Yes.
But that's a good point. Even with fans, you know what I mean? They come up to you and you're like, yeah, I try to always be gracious because who the fuck knows? And my fans are very specific. If they're in trouble,
I was wondering about
if they're in trouble, they'll tell me.
Oh, so you get people who are sharing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because you share.
Right, so much. And then I get emails sort of like, you got me through. I'm lucky to be here. It's nice.
Yes.
Why? What kind of fans do you
have? I feel the same way. Like there are people. One time, you know, so I got to explain a couple things.
Okay.
There was, when I was 19, I lost my anonymity. And I love these terms, and I don't want to offend people or war veterans who use this term PTSD.
Yeah.
There was a shift energetically when you're an introvert. So I was an introvert when I was younger. People don't associate me with this color of being sort of quiet.
Yeah.
So I lost my anonymity.
And what do you mean anonymity?
Anonymity, meaning I was now, if I went into a coffee shop,
energy. Oh, so you became a public person.
It became this. Look at that girl. Do you see her?
She's from Cape Fear?
Yeah.
Right.
It was Cape Fear is what really did it. So I had anxiety. I feared public places. How it manifested itself, I actually fear that violence because it's energy I can't control. So I get these violent images.
Someone's gonna hurt
our
you.
Time fucking validates it.
Yeah.
But back then.
Right.
So I would get anxiety in public places.
Right.
Anyway,
you thought someone was gonna hurt you?
Not me in particular.
Oh, wait, just in general?
Just in general. I was scared.
Shit was gonna go down.
Yeah, I was just scared of the energy I couldn't control.
Yeah.
So I was trying to get at is you said fans. One day after I grew up a little bit, I had this great therapeutic exercise that actually helped me, helped rid some of my panic attacks was a Rolling Stones concert.
Oh, that's great.
It was an amazing exercise.
What do you mean? How does this happen?
Okay, so I went with my friend, coincidentally, Mike Rappaport. We go back early 90s.
He's a talker.
Yeah, there you go. So he was just an actor back when.
He's doing stand-up again, you know.
Oh, yeah. I saw his show.
Where he just goes up and he basically does exact. He can be standing on a street corner talking to one guy or being on stage doing the exact same thing.
It was crazy. Yeah. I watched him and you don't know and you're coming out to support your friends, but he killed it. He did great.
Well, he's a character.
He's a character, but he did great. He did have.
Were at the Comedy Store?
Where was it? In Burbank. Was it Flappers?
Oh, Flappers. Yeah.
He did great. He had set up bits that they worked.
Well, he started as a comic.
And they were funny.
Kinda.
I did not know this.
A little bit.
I know him as a dramatic actor.
Well, no, before he did Zebrahead or whatever the hell that first movie was.
Yeah, that was the movie.
Yeah. He was like his sister, his half-sister, Claudia, her father is the part owner of the Improv. So he sort of started as doing stand-up to get sort of seen. But he did
have. I
have
no idea.
You're just hearing
Isn't
this for the
crazy?
First time?
I'm just hearing this, but isn't it crazy that now in midlife, sometimes your old seeds, you know, you know, you come into fruition, these seeds that were planted earlier. That's such a trip.
Yeah, now you can bring it up.
And now he's doing it.
Yeah, well, he did it, like I said before, but then I think he just did it to get into the acting.
Yeah.
And then he got into the, what movie did you do with him?
Well, we knew each other from an ex-boyfriend of mine who he worked with.
Oh.
And then me and Mike, so we knew each other then. And, and then we did this little tiny independent that my friend wrote that no one really saw called Some Girl.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you go to the Rolling Stones concert.
We go to the Rolling Stones concert. And then this, I love how the mind works because I'm going to benchmark it. We're going to come. You originally asked me, do you like your fans?
Right.
I'm going to.
We're getting there.
But so.
This is the tool. This is the, this is the Rolling Stones tool for being outside safely in your mind.
It was a therapeutic exercise.
Right.
Mike asked me to go.
Yeah.
And he didn't know all the struggles in my head. I'm picturing it's Dodger Stadium.
Oh, big one. When was this?
98.
Okay.
It might have been Babylon.
Yeah, that sounds right. The Wheels of Babylon.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. I saw your whole thing. Wait,
was it the Wheels something? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, is that great? I differ on a couple of things with you, but okay, so meaning I'll just accept artists. As long as they're not drunk and a mess, I will accept them at 100. I will accept them at, you know.
Yeah, well, I think I think I kind of do. I think that my discomfort around that kind of stuff is a projection.
Because
I know I'm getting older.
Yeah.
And there's part of me that's sort of like, why the fuck do they keep doing it? Because I don't want to do it anymore.
Yes, like, you're like.
Then when do I get to stop? I don't really want to stop, but there's part of me that's sort of like, it's so much pressure. How much Instagram do I have to do?
Yes.
Do I have to tweet?
You're why like, is this someone person? Point me the way. Oh, no, he doesn't do it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You want to be pointed the way.
But then you know, people and you see how much they post and you're like, oh, this is fucking horrible.
I knew this. That was my intro to social media was being in a little independent band. You know,
right.
No
yeah.
label or anything. I literally handed out flyers.
Juliet and the Licks.
Juliet and the Licks.
But that was like probably, but that was MySpace probably.
That was MySpace.
Right.
100%. And then Twitter just started.
Right.
Oh my God. I couldn't get over it. I was like, what? People just say sentences into space for no reason to no one?
And now it's driving the entire planet.
Ugh, I hate it.
The wild id of everything. All right.
Okay, go on.
So you go to the Rolling Stones.
Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I literally, so one of my favorite movies that helped me through my darkest times, which was when I was 22, I quit drugs. I had a couple things. It was a Bob Dylan song. And
which one?
She Belongs to Me.
Oh, yeah.
The lyrics in that song.
Oh, yeah.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. Best.
She's a hypnotist collector. I am a walking antique. Is that what it is?
Yeah, you it's remember crazy. The far out ones because I fuck up the second line, so I'm not going to say it.
I'm always sort of like, what does that mean? Yours is, I can understand.
The first two, they're like, that makes all the sense in the world. And then he goes off into metaphor.
Yeah.
It's cool as shit. Okay, so what's happening?
Stones.
Oh, what about Bob? So what about Bob? Bill Murray, the thing
Richard Dreyfuss, Bill Murray.
Yeah, he's a hypochondriac. Yeah. So I get out of the car. I love, you're playing pinball with my mind right now.
At the Stones concert.
This is how it happens. So I get out of the car. Where What About Bob ties in is I go, baby steps out of the car.
Yeah.
Baby steps through the parking lot.
Yeah.
All right. There's no shootout. We're
right.
in the parking lot. And Mike was so cool. I don't know if he remembers it the way I do, but he sort of, I explained my deep anxiety and he kind of held my hand through it. Like, you doing okay, Jules?
Yeah.
He calls me Jules. There's like three people in this world that calls me Jules. He's one of them. You doing okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good. All right. We're in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Okay, we're getting there. And so we get to Dodger Stadium. He had good tickets.
Yeah.
We're on the floor of Dodger Stadium. They haven't come on yet. He wants to go and get a soda.
Yeah.
And he's like, you gonna be okay?
Yeah.
Well... I'll try because we got to hold our, it's like standing room. There's no, it's a,
sure,
you're on the floor. There's no seats.
Space. Yeah.
So I go, yeah, I'm going to be okay. Just lie because I'm trembling. And so as an exercise, I made myself turn around and look at all the seats and all the people in Dodger Stadium. And it was, you know, like the skies, it was trepidation, but I looked around and I, you know, anxiety ridden, but I did an exercise and looked at that much rather than had blinders on and like just
were freaked out in your own head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I made myself look at that part, and then he came back. And then here's where the therapy happened. Once the fucking show started, something came over me. And I had fan energy. I had, and me and Mike joke about it, where me, Mick and Keith, I'm like, we love you, Keith! You know, and I'm like, he's looking at me, and I'm all my, I'm like a fan, a super fan. So I, it was weird, because this shift of understanding fanaticism and being that made me somehow understand, and not like I'm Keith, but you get, people have been excited to.
Well, no, it's like, it's like, that's exactly what that's for, though, is to relieve the existential predicament of you, like hero worship.
Yeah.
And believing in or having gods among the living is a great way to displace almost all of your anxiety.
I think it's great.
So how does that help you when you go into the supermarket?
I don't know, but something, sorry if I get too loud, something shifted. You know, you have these moments in your life where you have a little bit of,
clarity.
new revelation. I was in my mid-20s at that point. And so that was helpful.
I had one of those yesterday, actually. A minor one, revelation.
Okay.
It was,
that's cool.
I was just walking out of my house and I realized, like, I don't have to go anywhere to retire. You know, like, there's always this part of my mind where it's sort of like, I'm going to quit and I'm getting out. I'm going to go get a cabin.
I can't believe it. I always have thought this.
Yeah.
Go on.
You know,
the
like,
cabin,
I'm going
to get off the grid. Right. My boyfriend thinks this way. I'm like, you don't want to live.
Yeah. How long is that going to last? Uh-huh. But there is that party that's sort of, I'm going to move to Ireland. Like, the shit's going to go down with if Trump's reelected. I'm going to get out and whatever. But then I just had this moment where I'm like, wait, this is nice here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my sense of retiring or slowing down is really about, like, I'm anxious. I'm done with this shit. I don't like the expectations.
Yes,
you know, like, I'm like, I don't like the chase.
You put on yourself and the
others. Right.
Right. Okay.
And that's a mental thing. I think it's just a take on that. Like, you know, no matter where you go, there you are kind of shit.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's going to be the same until you change. It's an inside job, man.
Well, here's the thing is, those things we know, it's important to realize them anew every single time, like it's a new thought.
Oh, yeah.
You just keep realizing, be in the moment.
Well, sometimes
that's it. Be in the moment.
I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here. I'm here. Yeah, I mean, I feel that my entire career as a comic has something to do with facing fear.
Yes.
Now, what do you think when you go up on stage in whatever incarnation of you is the Juliet and the Licks? Is that a character?
No. I get asked this. Oh, and I face my fears when I do any kind of acting work. Because that mechanism, like, psh, you're doing that? You're not good enough. All that tunes in. But no, the Licks is, I don't know what I'm going to do ever musically. I have to defeat being, I have to repurpose.
Right.
But the Licks was my, what I liken as my, sort of like a high school band, but not in high school, but in when I was 30.
Yeah, yeah,
30.
No, but but it's good.
But when people ask, to me, it was like an exercising of all your emotionality. I always say I'm an emotionalist. So that was in rock and roll music, and I became, for me, I was like a conduit of the instruments, like the drumming. I was tapped into to drumming, bass, guitar, and then together we'd write songs, but they're very derivative rock music, because that's what I was able to do at that time with my bandmates. And but we were really, I was really proud of the shows, because the shows were all about connectivity, and people, I wanted them to lose their minds.
Yeah.
Basically, in the best sense.
In the way that you did with Keith Richards.
That's it.
So, but you grew up in this business.
Yeah.
Basically. Because I know, like, your dad,
Jeffrey Lewis.
Like, I remember him from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, he was, like, in every movie. He's in a lot of movies, a lot of the Clint Eastwood movies, but he's got that face, character actor guy.
You're saying exactly what I grew up with. Yeah. Like, you always know, I'd always say, you always know his face. You may not know his name. And he,
right.
He's a character actor. And
comedy me, and serious movies.
That's it.
He can do everything.
And I always, to me, that's, it, there's, I just follow so much of my dad's footsteps in that way. That I'm honored to be. I want to play characters. I didn't get into this business to be myself or to be cool.
Right.
But yeah, I do feel a little defensive when people are like, you grew up like a Hollywood kid. Cause we but we didn't, we weren't very, I grew up with not a lot of money with my mom initially.
What'd she do?
Well, she was having children. So she's a mom, was a mom full time. But she was a graphic artist.
Now they were, but this is the 70s.
She would do promotional stuff for companies, that kind of thing, but graphic design,
right?
Like pamphlet, you know.
But I always think of the 70s, like, yeah, I don't think of it as in the same way that I think of, like, I don't feel like it was privileged, but it seemed like a more kind of grittier, more exciting time in Hollywood. Like, I wasn't thinking of you as some sort of star
like Beverly
child.
Hills.
No,
you
no.
know, I wasn't that.
No, I wouldn't assume that your dad would be a Beverly Hills guy.
No.
I don't think Ned Beatty lived in Beverly
That's
Hills.
That's it. He's of that ilk. Gene Hackman. Yeah.
Well, Hackman's probably, like, Hackman sort of somehow transcended character acting.
He did.
But Ned Beatty didn't. Ned Beatty's another one of those guys who's in everything.
So awesome. But like, all those guys, yeah.
But did you, wait, were those guys around? Who were his friends?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. He wasn't really friends. My dad's funny.
What about with Clint? He was in every Clint Eastwood movie.
First, I should say, he's not here anymore. We're in the fourth year.
Sorry.
Thank you. But when we were growing up, he would befriend like stuntmen, and like he was really into, it was funny, as he reached midlife, which is what I knew, he's kind of an older dad when I was a kid, maybe mid 40s, 50s, and he would got into like street fighting and taking Muay Thai. My dad was so funny because he was such a contradiction. So he came up, like, he took dance in New York, right?
He was a New York actor?
Yeah, in New York, sort of Renaissance.
Sure.
But then he got really into everything that was macho.
Yeah.
Like knife collecting.
Later?
Guns. Later.
Yeah.
Because how can you say, have taken modern jazz with Martha Graham and then you're like, you know, then you wear what's those gun shirts? Hetchler and Koch?
Yeah.
Or some, I forgot what.
Well,
they're
I mean, what do you make of that?
I don't know. My dad's a funny, I think he likes archetypes and he was reaching into things that I don't know that he felt he totally was that.
Well,
he would emulate things a little bit.
Right. Cause so he started like in that sort of New York scene in the late '60s and that kind of trip.
Yeah. But he was, so where did they come from? We have a Lewis farm in Rhode Island.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Dilapidated, meaning the Lewis's.
Family owns one?
Yeah. My aunt Nancy lives up there.
Uh-huh.
And then he came with his parents to out in nowhere, Victorville. I shouldn't say that. The Victorvillians would think they're somewhere. It's just desert.
It's here?
And Wrightwood. It's in the mountains.
Here?
But yeah, in California.
Oh, okay. So
he grew up there and then went back to New York. My mom is from the East Coast. She went to like Cooper Union.
Cooper Union, sure. Yeah.
They were like East Coasters for a bit.
Yeah.
But he started working late in life.
Uh-huh.
In midlife, he got success as an actor, like with Clint Eastwood movies.
Clint took a real liking to him.
Yeah.
Well, he did that. He was also, I guess, in some of those earlier, he was in that, he was in Warren Oates Dillinger.
He was in Dillinger.
Yeah.
What's it, High Plains Drifter.
Oh, yeah,
he has
this
famous line. He's such a baddie. He does, "Who are you?" And he's like, that's his. Oh my gosh.
So when did you start? Did you spend any time on sets? Like what planted in you?
Yes.
You did.
So my introduction to acting land was going, hanging out with my dad on sets where we, and there are a lot of cowboys. So we were on Bronco Billy. Oh, my first time being on camera is because Clint is like, sure, put your kid in the audience scene.
Yeah.
And there's a shot of just me as being an extra in that movie. I was like seven.
Right.
But what I knew about this environment was it was really long hours.
Yeah.
All the sets I'd been on were dusty.
Right.
And there were really colorful, interesting people.
Yeah.
That gravitated.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, from people with sordid backgrounds. Yeah. We have no idea. Yeah. Same with rock and roll. People who set up the stages. And
right.
So it was I knew later in life, oh, okay, this is the line of work, quote unquote, you go into when you live in your imagination or you like storytelling or characters, which I dreamed a lot of as a kid. That occupied my headspace a lot.
It's interesting. Like when did you I hear this word storytelling so much now, and I'm not sure I remember hearing it like before a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like, do you remember when you started using that word?
Yeah. For me, you know, you hear phrases and you're like, oh, that describes it, because I didn't know what it was.
I just noticed it. I'm not judging you.
No, okay.
Because
storyteller.
Well, no, I talk to actors, I talk to directors, and they're like,
storyteller.
Right. Everyone's sort of like, it's really about telling the story. I'm like, did everyone always say this, or is it a new thing? It's kind of new,
there's
right?
There's so much new shit, too, that you're like, yeah, this is the new thing. Triggered. I like this word. I'm like, all right, I'll take it.
Authenticity.
Authenticity.
Yeah, that's a new one.
Storytelling. So for me, though, I didn't know what it was called as a kid.
No, I know. I believe.
I have to tell you, too, I had the 70s, 80s. Mm. What do they call it? There's another phrase, latchkey kid.
Latchkey kid, yeah.
Yeah, we were left alone a lot. Yeah. Like, it might border on a little neglect.
Uh-huh.
So my parents are awesome and they're artists, but we didn't have a lot of structure.
Were they out partying?
No. No, working. My mom still raised kids, but was working.
So, like,
she had six total, my mom.
Oh, my God. So, like, where are you in the lineup?
So... of my mom and dad's brood, it goes my brother, me, my sister.
Yeah.
And then she married again and had one kid.
Yeah.
And that's Bo, who's my hero.
The New Orleans guy.
Yep. Yeah. And then there's another two kids she had from her third and final husband.
And she's still around?
Yes.
That's nice. Are they still married?
No.
Oh.
My mom has been single for an eternity. My mom... okay, it's my dream to play aspects of my mom. She's funny.
You haven't done that yet?
I've looked like my mom in film. Or coming up, actually, this Mark Ruffalo HBO show. I look so much like my mom. Anytime I curl my hair, she had curly red hair. She's super Irish.
This is an upcoming show you're on?
Upcoming show.
That he produced or he's in?
He stars in.
What is it?
It's called I Know This Much Is True from a Wally Lamb book.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be a six-part.
You in all six?
Limited. I'm in three.
Great.
Yeah.
You keep working.
It's a part. It's a funny.
Yeah.
It's a
and you got
funny
your mom.
So
you can see your mom in there.
I see, not in the way I act in the show, but just visually, it's pretty hilarious.
So when you start doing the work, Latchkey Kid, hanging out, but there's three and before. When did they get divorced? Though,
when I was two.
Oh, so
really
you're...
little. I've always known my parents to be split.
All right, so your mom.
With my mom for a bit, and then when they decide, okay, I have more kids, and now you're doing okay financially, why don't you take the kids? It was like that. It was like economics.
So you always lived with one or the other?
Yes.
You never ran away?
Oh, yeah, of course. What are you kidding? Well, and I left home at 14.
Where'd
call
you go?
That running away. I set out to live in the world. Was I 14? 15. 14. It's really
who
young.
Took you in?
Okay, so My a family friend.
Yeah.
Her name is Karen Black.
The actress.
Yes.
Okay.
And she, I lived.
Whose friend was it? She your dad's or your mom's?
Both. She was both my mom and dad's friend. I would go to her house when I was a kid. I knew her since I was a little wee baby. Here's the great irony is that working, and this is funny, as I look back, I'm like, oh, that's hilarious. Working in TV and film kept me out of trouble.
Right.
For initially, until, you know, I imploded. Fame was troubling.
Right.
As a teenager.
Yeah.
But initially, I was, you know, a teenager ditching school, failing, hanging out with criminals.
Really?
Yeah. That was the thing, is when we talk about the mind, different people, different spirits, like you come into this world just having a different, like for me, it was how much trouble can I get in and survive?
Yeah,
and that's
I kind of,
you know, people would probably think something of this sort of me, but I don't know.
I had that, that's odd because I had a similar mindset in that, like, you know, how will I know if I'm losing my mind? That, like, I was a little nervous about too much trouble, but like when it came to drugs or other kinds of stuff,
right.
I had this sort of like line.
You're pushing
my,
it.
Like, yeah, like, will I know? Like, if I lose my mind, I'm going to stop. Like, you're going to know.
How that. I was just, do you know, I've pondered on this because I thought I lost my mind once, and I did say to myself, oh, how you know you've lost my mind is you don't know.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
When was that?
That was
when you were losing it. All right, so you're running around. Did you finish high school or did you?
I got my GED, and got a tutor. So I technically, but I did not finish high school.
But you're acting starting when you're what, 12 or what?
Yeah, 12 and a half, 13.
When did you
14.
Do Cape Fear at 15?
That I was playing younger, but I turned 18 during the movie.
Oh, so you did, right? You did Vacation, the second Vacation
at 15. Yeah, yeah,
right.
That was great.
And then you did, that's a funny movie.
I'm having all these moments, Mark. I have to say,
yeah,
these midlife moments where you get to give thanks. I don't know, appreciation to the people that took a chance on me and or the reason I got from A to B. And so one of them is we had this little, anniversary of Christmas Vacation.
You did?
With Chevy Chase.
Oh, that's right. I remember seeing pictures of that.
And Beverly D'Angelo and Johnny Galecki, who went on to do his show.
Yeah.
It was really sweet and Chevy was in good form and it was just sweet because that movie plays every year
for Christmas.
What are the chances?
Yeah. And you get those little checks.
I get those little checks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they started putting some faces on merchandise. So, let's see.
Really?
What's happening over there?
It's still that pot. Really? It's still happening, huh?
Yeah. They do Christmas Vacation stuff.
It's a holiday movie.
It's a holiday movie.
That's amazing. You made the cut.
I don't know. I don't know. I just showed
There's
up.
There's only a few movies that end up making, like Elf is another one, fairly modern movie that gets a lot of play.
That's true.
Over Christmas. So wait, Karen Black is a family friend and also one of the most inspired, unique actresses ever. And you live with her a bit?
And she was an influence. I mean,
it's a wild influence. I could see that. How did she influence you? Were you taking acting classes? Were you doing anything?
No. So part of my development is stuff like playing charades at Karen Black's house when I was little, and her going, okay, now you're a such and such. She would just call out something to play.
Right.
And she validated me early on. She was really just a beautiful person.
Is she still around?
She's not around.
Oh.
She left or went. I hate the word died.
Yeah.
Before my dad. So hers would be 5 years ago. But she really validated. You know, there's these key people who encourage you. You have a voice.
I would have loved to have seen you guys work together.
She wanted that very much. It never happened. I know. We wanted to play mother and daughter.
Yeah.
But she's very much, I always call her sort of my creative mother of sorts. And then you see her work. It's like, oh, okay.
You can see the
I don't know. Just when there's someone, not so much just when someone's so individual. They're so much themselves. So that's all I ever strive to be is unfiltered, you know, just being.
Right. So that's sort of counter, like, intuitive to character acting, though. You know what I mean? Like, she could do all these things, but she could never. She may get lost in a role, but you always knew it was her. It's interesting. I always notice this about actors is that some actors are always kind of themselves, but they just turn some knobs.
Yes.
But they always, like, Clooney's great, right?
Yeah.
Great actor, but he's always Clooney.
Yeah.
But he can make adjustments to where you believe anything he's doing because he's good. So he's a movie star.
Yeah.
But then there are people that there are actors that you generally know the source of who they are. They don't lose that.
Yeah.
But they just make adjustments and they can do whatever they want to do. But they're not, you know, it's not like they're not doing weird voices and shit.
Yeah. There's like
not learning any accents.
People that are mostly themselves and bringing what that is.
Yeah.
Or there's like a Benicio del Toro. Remember when he was first in Usual? He's just coming up to me because he was in Usual Suspects, and he made this choice of like mumbling every line of sentence.
Yeah,
he mumbled. Yeah, like, what the fuck choice is this? It was amazing.
He's continued making that choice.
Okay.
It's a choice he stuck with.
All right, maybe he's not the example. See, that's
my you worked with him, though, on some movie.
I did. But
when you were younger.
My tortures, I want to disappear and become somebody else. But yes, you're always going
to
be.
You want to be present. I think it's a present thing. Like for me.
Oh, yeah, totally. And 100%. I want to make it look like you do not see any acting, like it's breathing.
That's right. So it's like you're losing yourself, but you're not. It's mostly to be in the moment. Like, because to lose that self-consciousness that you were talking about, you know, to where you're freaked out about this or that, you know, violence or. For me, it's people judging you. You know, it's a unique person that can get on a set and not acknowledge, you know, in the sense, and do the work in front of, you know, 50 to 100 people, you know, surrounding them in different jobs.
Yes.
And to sort of be present and be in that scene, right? To get past this stuff.
Yes.
I mean, that's the real gift. I mean, you know, you lose yourself, but it's just your brain's not spinning your regular shit. So that's how you lose yourself, because you're engaged.
Engaged in the moment. And what I like to say, and transcend. So, you know, when you get really lucky, you hit a kind of transcendence.
Oh, yeah.
Where all the machinery or you really enter into the make-believe. You're creating a different reality.
Right.
I don't know.
And you feel it like when you come out of the scene where cut. And you're like, what? Right?
Yes.
That, like, I'm just starting to understand that about acting. I was kind of like a little bit stupid about it. Like, I didn't like all the waiting around. But like, if you lock into what you're doing and you have enough of a part to really do something, that's what the payoff is.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? You do your shit, and then it's like, all right, it's gonna take an hour and a half before we're set up for the next one. It's like, okay, fine. That one was good. Let's do the next.
How
one.
Do you do? And well. This is what's funny about, because every job I do, I'm like, oh, yeah, you have muscle memory, but nothing is easier. I was like, wow, I thought this would, I'll never coast, because I never want automaticities. So I don't, and if I find, it, you know, because sometimes when you come up to, you have things that people then, if they imitate it, or you're like, oh, I don't want those to become tricks.
Right.
But you can see, things, you know, when I cry, look like how I cry. I don't know. When I say I want to lose myself, meaning I would love if my voice changed, if I didn't look like myself and this and that. But more importantly than all that, that's another version of ego.
Yeah.
You want to prove you can transform. But really, I just want to, again, tell the story. I want to be as honest and rich and multi-layered. I really love contradictions in people, in humanity.
And that you can pull that, like that, that's your engagement with a script, though. You know, the script will dictate some of that. And also, like, you're one of those people that is uniquely yourself. There's nothing you can do. You know what I mean? Like, you're one of those identifiable people. Like, oh, that's Juliet. You know, like, there's no way, you know, which is a good thing. That, because you have a rawness in your emotional accessibility that you have with yourself, and your willingness to to be open is what engages that weird authentic thing that you have.
That's neat.
Don't you think so?
Well, yeah, I don't.
That's neat. I was trying to.
Yeah. I like this. Yeah. I'm like, how will he describe what I do? That sounds pretty good. No, I know what I'm feel and what I struggle or what I transcend internally. But yes, it's funny externally when early on when a few people started imitating or making fun of me.
Like
I was like,
SNL
oh, shit. That, yeah, I got some SNL imitations. And the good thing is I never was too.
Oh, yeah. Who did that? Was that where they did the retainer thing?
I think it was Janine Garofalo. Oh, yeah. But they did a lot of mannered stuff.
Yeah.
And you got to understand at the time, before I did KVR, I did freaking 80s sitcoms where they didn't want any naturalism. It was like, don't move your hands, stand up straight.
So you're getting those parts.
I was right before.
The little girl thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was super weird. They were trying to conform me early. It's a hilarious story I tell. Before I got KFUR, they hired an acting coach for me to get me to stop acting natural.
Oh, really?
Basically. Yeah, just
because you're fidgeting.
It was a sitcom.
You're doing your thing.
Well, and I was like leaning against the sofa and behaving like a freaking teenager.
Right.
Knowingly.
Yeah.
And they wanted these, gee, Dad, you don't know. You know, this.
Yeah.
That was the great, that was hilarious.
That is funny.
So everything they were trying to, I almost gave it up at 16 and then I got the audition and then I always say that everything they were, Marty validated what I needed to carry
Scorsese
on.
Scorsese.
Yes.
Yeah. True. Oh, right.
Special. He was going, yes, you know, and he knew to like, let me go. He just sort of gave me the room, the space, and the material, and all those. He's just a genius because he knows what each actor needs. Like I didn't know. I didn't. Again, I'm not academic.
You're 18,
right? I wasn't academically trained either. So it was all instincts,
right?
And he helped cultivate that my instincts, basically.
So that was like a whole graduate level.
100%. Yeah. I always say my directors were my teachers.
And so that's when everything. Now your folks were okay with you acting, obviously, right?
Yeah. Again, I jokingly, which I love. We have great humor in my family and with my mom.
Yeah.
When I said they're neglectful, I mean, they're busy folks. I had the opposite of what you hear, like, you're going to do this. And, you know, and.
Yeah. Right.
So the point is, they sort of anything their kids. My dad was a great facilitator. Like, oh, you're interested in. Like, my brother, he gave a camera to because my brother was watching TV and he loved videos.
Right.
So he gave him a camera.
Right.
And I took like dance and singing and all this little stuff as a kid.
So after Cape Fear, though, that was a huge movie. You work with De Niro and you work with Nick Nolte and who was the mom?
Jessica Lange.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a wild
movie. Movie of greats.
Yeah. And that was exciting for you? Were you able to keep your shit together or?
Yeah. What's funny, I had another full circle moment when I got to have a dinner with De Niro and Scorsese, Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Who played my dad.
When was this?
Recently at the AARP award. I gave Marty an award and had a just beautiful. I've had a few, like a tribute to De Niro some years ago. I got to speak. And but my point is, at that time, it all worked for me. I didn't know what they meant to American cinema.
Sure.
So my naivete it worked great.
Right.
Because I didn't know to be shitting my pants on this job.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do a really, all I knew is that this was the time.
Yeah.
Like, you better do something.
Yeah.
You better really be powerful. And that for me, that's by being as honest.
Yeah.
And rich as possible
playing
the young girl. But Marty, what's so great is he wanted a fully dimensional, you know, not these vapid things we'd seen on screen. He wanted the family, and he actually, because it was a remake from the 50s, he wanted the family to have all this subversion and and complexity.
Moral complexity.
Exactly.
Right.
The daughter's
the
mad.
The Gregory Peck character was not like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he made that clear to all of us. And so every scene had a thing of, you know, where the family distrust.
Sexual tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or moral dubiousness, masculinity issues.
Yeah, yeah. All of that.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah. He really kind of expanded the whole subtext of the movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it makes it scarier.
It's funny because I did one scene with De Niro, you know, in The Joker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. You were in The Joker. Yes.
For a second.
Right.
But, like, I was very excited about it, and I was able to respect what was happening, enjoy what was happening. And even with Joaquin, who was not communicative because he was immersed.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, all right, you know, I'm not going to judge him for that. He's doing what he's doing.
No, I worked with a friend like that. I was like, we are completely different, but you know what? That's what it takes to get you to go there. And for me, I got to step out of it when we say cut. I can't sit in this.
Right. So yeah, we're not going to be talking at the craft services
table.
That's
it.
You can go over there and brood and talk to yourself.
That was Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll mind. I mean, that's how he worked.
I've interviewed him.
At that time. You did?
Yeah, yeah. A while back.
He's intense, but he had to stay in it.
Great actor.
That's what I'm saying. If you weren't good, then I would judge you harder.
He's kind of done some sort of like amazing work.
Yes.
In the past. Like in movies that I don't think people really know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've seen him as he got older, but like that shit he did in that movie with... what was it called? The Gift?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man. The Blue Diamond shit.
So funny because he won't let you compliment him. He's one of the... He can't... Uh-huh. But now I think he's old enough. I'm like, shut up. You're a titan. This was the lingo that came out of me.
Are you guys friends?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm best friends with his sister. But he did a movie. We just did this little independent movie recently called from the James Frey book about
addiction. Million Little Pieces, the one that turned out to be bullshit.
The book, yes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go.
No, I've talked
Maybe
to him.
Maybe it was just one bit.
I have a problem
with that too. It's like, unless if you're a writer, I mean, can't we, when we sit and talk, sometimes we exaggerate.
Oh, no.
What was the problem? I don't know what he did.
No, at the time.
Did he lie saying, I got arrested and you didn't get arrested?
Yeah, he manufactured a lot of the story.
Okay.
And he's a good writer. That was always the thing with him, was sort of like, why didn't you just say
this is my friends. Yeah, that is true. Okay.
You know, and he took a hit for it. And he's one of the first ones to really get nailed like that.
That's it.
And like he, you know, it hit him pretty hard. But you know, it was clear that he was a good writer. But they're making a movie about it.
They made it, and it's one of the. You know, it's really hard to
do. I can't remember when did it come
small
out.
Small films. It had a little release at our ArcLight here. I mean, all over limited release. It starred Aaron Taylor Johnson and directed by Sam Taylor Johnson, who's an incredible filmmaker. They're married.
Oh, okay.
It's beautiful. It's very poetic. But anyway, Giovanni was in that and is transcendent. Do I say transcendental?
Transcendent. It's good.
He's phenomenal.
And his sister acted, but does she do it anymore? Or is there another one? Or is there two?
No, it was Marissa Ribisi. She totally was an actor for a while, and it's not really her thing. She wrote. She was the friend. I love this. Comes full circle.
Yeah.
That I did Some Girl. She wrote that with my other good best friend, Bree Schaefer.
Yeah.
They wrote this really cool L.A. story called Some Girl that Mike Rappaport was in.
Right.
But she's a mom of two, and she did some clothes designing. She's just one of these creators. Of mine.
Right.
But she's not really an actor person.
Yeah, because I talked to him a while ago. I think it was a good interview, but it got tense because I asked him about the church.
Yeah.
And it gets a little weird sometimes.
I thought that would come up, and I have all...
So you've known them through that.
For you and I.
Yeah, you've known them through that?
Vonnie? No.
Oh.
There's a whole bunch of friends that I have from Los Angeles, but not specifically through Scientology.
But you grew up in it?
Let's see how I would define this. Again, because my parents they're very like, I would call it free thinkers.
Right, sure.
But the problem with the discussion of Scientology is there's so much, I don't know if you'd call it folklore, that might be true for other people and their experience.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. So So the point is to grow up in something. Nothing was ever forced on me. Not
right.
schooling, right. not my right. profession, not right. religion. So I didn't grow up in a household like, this is what we believe,
right.
and this guy is a deity.
Right.
And I did grow up with, there's concepts in Scientology.
Sure.
Like we had things like, it's really basic stuff like
yeah.
communicating or valuing
right.
what a little kid, their point of view.
Uh-huh.
These are things not written, but that
right.
you should listen
sure.
to people.
Right.
But as far, there's a metaphor I wanted to use of like, because all this stuff, it's so bad about Scientology. And
reading this stuff that you
TV show, all the stuff that,
but there is reality to that. It wasn't your reality.
It's not my reality.
Right.
So it's like I always make the analogy. And first of all, I'm a spiritualist.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to define me, I don't like when me as Juliet is defined by something else
well,
or an
people,
association with
right.
Far as like my philosophical beliefs,
yeah.
I have everything from the tethered soul. Is that the latest?
Yeah.
That's the latest book.
Untethered
Soul.
Untethered Soul.
Not tethered.
Right.
And then I just got this other book called Welcoming the Unwelcome, which is all I'm trying to fucking figure out. You know, I have a friend, three friends who have stage 4 cancer.
Oh.
I have a friend who fell on his bike, is in the hospital. So all these things are hard to navigate. But back to the Scientology discussion.
Yeah.
So here's the analogy.
Yeah.
If someone came out and did a show
yeah.
on veganism and
sure.
how if you veganism, it made me sick, my
right.
organs,
right.
this happened and this happened. And you have another person who's like, well, that was my experience is totally different.
Right.
I'm in no place to ever invalidate someone else's experience, but I don't want my experience to be invalidated too.
Or associated with
associated.
It.
Associated. That's the other thing is some of these people who have all the negative slant, they'll take anybody's name who's been associated with
yeah.
Scientology and say that you're condoning these horrible feeling things that they have. I'm not any, that's
well,
not.
Well, the weird thing was to me, like, and I'm no historian about it, so like, I really can't do the sort of kind of like the pressing,
in-depth
or pressing interview about it. But, you know, like any sort of modern belief system or something that seems or starts out as a cult is that there was a time where the ideas were out there and free to take and utilize how anyone might want to. There were people who entered Scientology in the 70s as a self-help sort of option, took what they needed from it and moved on.
Yeah.
There are very smart people that, you know, read some of the stuff of Hubbard's process and validated it and used it in their life, but didn't get locked into the church.
Yeah.
And then there's levels within the church, it seems, of, you know, adepts, new people, the way the church has evolved over time, the depth of the teachings, you know, what it requires of you financially, that like any other sort of racket, you know, causes trouble, causes problems.
And the people who are explaining that are people that are disgruntled and upset.
Or in some cases, they felt, you know, abused and violated.
Yes. And that's where I'm like, if you ever think or have experienced abuse,
yeah.
do all the appropriate channels
sure.
to nail anybody to the wall.
Well, what was your experience with it? Do you still...
Me? Mine is sort of come and go as you please.
Right.
I've done read books. I've done some courses.
Right.
I've done the auditing, which is the equivalent of, you know, sitting, talking
yeah.
and delving into your mind. And,
yeah.
And I had things that were really helpful for me
yeah.
early on. But... That's so I don't have the thing of that I'm owned or tied into something.
Right.
I don't have this thing of I'm an opinionated questioning
sure.
person.
And also you went through some serious shit, some serious turmoil and trouble
yeah.
and crisis in your life. And, you know, it didn't seem to, you know, offer whatever support was necessary.
I did get help at this time when I was 22.
Oh, you did?
Oh,
from the church?
I don't even like this term. All right, from the church,
from the organization.
But yeah, like doing. It's something you sort of you learn and you apply.
Okay,
so if there's little things like everything, Hubbard has written down things like a locational thing, a process you do where you orient yourself in the environment.
Yeah.
If you're feeling overwhelmed.
Uh-huh.
So there's like little things like this you would never hear about because you only hear about all this other stuff with money and stuff like that. But
the specific writings and teachings you don't hear about. That's for sure.
Yeah. Where you're like, what are people into?
People mock it more than anything else. They mock the thetans and they mock holding the cans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which I can take mocking of all different kinds. I don't care. What I do care about is do not take my name that I worked, that I live in my skin and associate it with a story that's not my own. That,
right.
You know,
I
mean, our experience that are not my own. That's all.
Yeah,
that's all I'd ask. That's all I would give to somebody else. But as far as, and also money and shit, I get Reiki healing. I'm really into this. I do acupuncture.
Yeah.
These are things paid for. Anyway. Okay, so.
But what does that mean? So you do give.
I'm saying you pay for a service.
Any sort of spiritual.
But I don't have it. But people are looking at, what about the 100,000? That's not my experience. I didn't pay $100,000.
Okay,
so I don't know. That's not my experience.
Yeah,
maybe it was yours.
You're not part of the tithing.
No.
Okay. So wait. So now tell me. So locational.
Yeah.
I like that. Locational is good.
And you'll see some of this stuff is like, it's common sense stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, looking around, I've used that when I was.
Well, it's sort of like an extension.
Orienting yourself. Like when you're about to do a show, you can look around. I'll look to the back of the room.
But it's like that moment you had at the Stone Show.
That's it.
Yeah.
So maybe it's sort of doing something.
Rooted in that.
Yeah.
But what was the, like, how did, because like, I'm fortunate in that I've never gotten that famous.
Yeah.
Like I keep a kind of mid-level presence publicly.
Okay.
My celebrity has never achieved. I can still live a comfortable life and go to the store.
Right.
So when all that started happening to you, what was the direct effect? Like, how did you know that you were losing it? Like, what was it that you felt caused it outside of, like, the going to the supermarket and feeling the fear of violence? What was...
Well, before that, it didn't go straight to that. It was just more the energy shift.
Like when Natural Born Killers, right? Right?
No, I saw that recently. Another full circle moment. Was totally crazy, but Oliver and Woody Harrelson.
Yeah,
Oliver Stone, Woody Harrelson, they were screening... 25th anniversary of Natural Killing.
Yeah, I think I talked to Woody like the day of that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I love Woody so much. Oliver, you know, he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
But I watched it and I am all raw fucking.
Yeah.
I knew, Oliver let. He wanted the playing field. He wanted every idea you had. It was like a guttural purging.
Yeah.
He created the environment. We could improvise. We could do all that. Because I knew I was sort of going to wield lightning.
But also, I have to assume that as an actress and somebody who's a searcher like you and the idea of, you know, getting out of yourself, I mean, you know, to take, you know, to push the envelope given the opportunity must have been pretty relieving.
It was really fun. So, yes, there's these movies that shaped me.
Yeah.
And Natural Born Killers is one of them because Oliver wanted you could not be lazy. Like he just wanted every idea. So he really valued people's creativity.
And yeah.
Like I'd show up, I wrote a scene, he'd be like, "Yeah, let's do that." And it was psychedelic. It was a psychedelic film in that you're going to go, okay, you're driving in a car and you're trying to get away from the cops, but there's demons running by the window.
Right.
So just act that. You're like, how the fuck? What does that look like? You're on mushrooms, fearing the cops, and then there's devil people. You know, so it's the ultimate make-believe shaping you up. You know, and for me, it's a flawed. I almost say it's a little bit campy, but I know I scared a lot of people, so that's
As
cool.
a comic, I thought that the weird thing on TV with Rodney Dangerfield, that was the fucking greatest. Like, it was weird and fucked up.
Yes.
To get Rodney into that zone.
like, who dreamt that up? I know, I know that Oliver, how that came about, you know, and they, there's all that friction or history that it was Tarantino's script. And, you know, I didn't know this whole backstory.
Right.
I'm just
sure,
an actor
sure.
coming on. Yeah. But so a lot of it's Oliver's subversion of what was there. And so he, I sort of said, because I was like, if you want any, I don't know if Oliver will remember this either, but I said, you can't have a female be this way without some kind of, it just never was in history that you, so with Eileen Warnes, like all we had of female serial killers are very specific. So I was like, some of it's got to have a backstory or something, which I know later I talked to Tarantino. He was like, he hated this idea that, you know, no, Mickey and Mallory are just the way they are, natural born killers.
Yeah.
But so my...
That was Tarantino?
That was Tarantino. Yeah. But to Oliver, I said, yeah, you got to show, I mean, I don't know, this might be too crazy. You got to show that Mallory came from something that made her like a fucking hyena or something.
Right.
And he took that and then did a laugh track, weird
sitcom thing,
with the family, laughter with the molestation. You know, so that was his freak show mind.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
You were on the set with Rodney for a day or two?
Oh my God. What a lovable, lovable, sweet man. And I had to jump on his back and I think I might have hurt his back. Even though I was light, he was like, oh, you know, be easy. I'm not going to try
be
to do
easy,
it.
Easy, will you?
Yes. I wasn't going to try to give you an impersonation.
Hey, listen, kid. Yeah. Oh, I tell you.
Yes, he was like, I think we did a couple takes of me hopping, jumping on his back, and he was like, all right, that's enough. But he trying to be a sport in the lunacy.
All right, so the transition from anonymous you to not anonymous you, that led to the sort of meltdown?
No, I think on the way, you know, earlier, you got to go earlier.
Oh, okay, yeah,
I was like, I had always that split. Problem of medicating. I was a crazy pot smoker and then trying to be good, not medicate.
Yeah.
And then all that, you know, responsibility, because you feel sort of responsible for why you're getting this attention. Yet I was just turning 21.
Right.
And so I remember a switch going off in my mind going, fuck it.
Right.
I'm going to act like any 21. Because everybody kept saying, oh, you're just 21. You're just 20. Because I was actually trying to navigate sort of a grown-up, responsible thing.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the tools for it.
Right.
So I did get into drugs.
Yeah.
I don't really specify.
Uh-huh.
Because then people,
they'll hang it on you. Did you did you go to rehab or you didn't?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I did. Well, I didn't technically go to a rehab, but I had a sober, like a person help me.
Oh, yeah.
Detox and stuff at 22.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it was that type of drug. You know,
right.
Detox.
Sure. So, and then,
okay, I'll just say, because I love in drug culture, because I was a downer person.
Yeah.
Because in drug, it was like, what?
I was
fucking
upper,
acid?
Coke
or meth or. Cause,
yeah.
So I was, I was the downer.
You like to go down.
I don't know, or did painkiller.
Sure,
thing,
sure. Well, no, I mean, I can tell you're hyper. Why not, like, level it out?
There you go.
But for me,
this is my cold brew and, whatever.
Cold brew, get me.
Home stretch.
I think cocaine had to, I think it had a Ritalin effect on me. Like,
were you focused?
Yeah.
Right, yes.
Froze me up, you know?
Yeah, it does that.
But so if you could name then, because it's interesting in thinking about the movies, from Cape Fear, Natural Born Killers, but then even that it wasn't a huge part, but it was a significant part in, was it Husbands and Wives? Which was it?
Oh, yeah, that was a big deal.
It was a big deal because, you played kind of a regular college student person. It's
there
like, look, she's fucking normal.
Yeah.
She's fucking normal.
No, here's what's funny. So I had this thing, and you can't, it's just luck of the draw.
And you were like the one young character woman in a movie that he had sexual chemistry with that he didn't fuck.
Yeah.
In the relationship. In the movie.
Yeah. So, Yeah, so here's the trip. I had this run in the early 90s where you're like, what the fuck? Who gets
What's eating
this?
Gilbert Grape?
So that's Lasse Hallström. Yeah. I'm a normal sort of zen girl. I'm telling you, the Natural Born Killers was the cap on it, and that's where everyone was like, holy shit, this girl is nuts.
So it would go from Cape Fear, Husbands and Wives, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, California, Natural Born Killers. There was other movies.
Yeah.
But those are the ones.
Those are the ones that hit. Yeah. Like some are cult classics like the California. But where I did that didn't hit was the comedy. I did a comedy with Steve Martin. It was a Nora Ephron comedy called Mixed Nuts.
Yeah.
With Sandler, Rita Wilson.
That dropped after Natural Born Killers or right?
That was in between. Yeah, I followed Natural Killers. It hadn't come out yet.
Yeah.
I did a Steve Martin little Nora Ephron comedy.
Cute.
No one saw it.
Oh.
So had someone saw it, they would have changed who I was.
But this new, I guess we should talk a little bit.
About current things.
The Sacred Lies, The Singing Bones.
Yeah.
It looks pretty intense.
It's a good mystery, I'm happy to say. Like, it's it looks real like cliffhanger, character-driven.
Supernatural elements?
It feels that way, but it's not.
Okay.
It's more like flashback.
Mm.
It's a movie, a show, not a movie.
Yeah.
So this new thing, Facebook Watch. You get these offers, and you're like, what is this
platform?
How
do you see it?
Yeah, everyone has it. It's so simple. You just go online, click some buttons, and you're there. Everyone who has a Facebook page. Well, and you can download it like you do Hulu, Apple, blah, 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 on your big remote. I don't know how to work those things.
Me neither.
My boyfriend does that.
Good.
So the point is,
this
was a great team. You have Raelle Tucker, who had done True Lies? No, that's not the name. True Blood!
True Blood. Thank
God. Oh, my God. Even pitching correctly.
You did it.
She was a writer. Okay. She's the show creator. It's character-driven cliffhanger.
Is it procedural? No.
No. Not at all.
What's the pitch?
I'm a terrible pitcher.
What is it about?
Oh, so I'm obsessed. I'm sort of this hermit person shut in.
Are you a professional?
Not at all.
Oh, you're just a person.
I'm a person who lost her sister, her sister was murdered.
Okay.
It is what is my driving obsession, is to always find and give the identities back to all these cold cases.
Oh.
And it's loosely based on an amalgamation of cold cases.
Mm.
And there's 40,000, I think.
Really?
Unnamed murdered victims.
Is that true?
Fuck, I better get my numbers right. A year? No. Just existing today, 40,000.
Yeah.
But it's something that Raelle Tucker, the creator, was really researched it. And so there's this really involved story where I befriend a foster girl because we think she might be connected to this, that, and the other. But I'm obsessed. I'm one of these people that's obsessed with true crime and cold cases, but it comes from a deep place of trauma. So it's like this really multi-layered character, I guess.
Wow.
And she's super, no vanity. It was a fun character to play. She's a gay woman who's very, but semi-antisocial, but has a huge heart.
And she just sort of, so you it can go on forever because there's 40,000 of them.
Well, no, the Singing Bones is this one case.
Oh, okay.
It's all related to this one case. And it was a season before, I guess they call it an anthology, where it's different people, case each time. It's this whole thing now. People do limited series.
No, I know.
Series.
That's the way it's instead of movies.
I like it. Limited miss the movies, don't get me wrong, but I do like limited series as well.
Now, were you happy for you? I didn't realize you did two movies with Brad Pitt, both of them kind of menacing. You did like a Lifetime movie with him back in the day, and you did California.
Okay, let me just say something. Yeah. It's not a Lifetime movie. This was pre-Lifetime, but you could call it an after school special kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Early
on. But it was before you both were.
It was before. We were just two little young actors. It's a cool piece of history to come up, come up with him, come up with Leo DiCaprio and Johnny Depp. But and then we did California.
Yeah.
And that was neat.
That was
a trip.
Movie.
That was a first-time director, Dominic Senna, who went on to do big, huge movies like Gone in 60 Seconds.
Uh-huh. I think. Do you talk to Brad ever?
I've run it. We've seen each other places.
Yeah.
Different times.
Like
when he was married to Jennifer earlier, said hello to both of them. And
were you happy for him?
Oh my gosh, yes. We're just like, it's like people you sort of, not school, but you sort of, you came up together. So, and he's a very good person.
Yeah.
So I always wish him well. And so I was very happy for his whole year he had. And yeah.
No, that's great. Cause a lot of times I ask people that and they're like, yeah, I never talk to them anymore. No, I don't know. Like, you know, obviously not everyone keeps in touch with everybody they work with, but it sounds like, you know, you're grateful and happy and it's always good to see them.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, there's people in your life I don't know, not family, but my ex-husband. I mean, I was married for a minute. We were both 26.
Yeah.
But like, he's like family to me. I don't talk to him all the time, but I always, you just want health and happiness for the
you don't have
certain
any
people.
Resentment or
not
deep.
At all.
And also, like, I, you know, now I've kind of half been thinking about what you said at the beginning for the entire thing about, like, you know, like that you part ways with me on my opinion of the Rolling Stones. I do want to be clear that, you know, I'm not an ageist.
That's the word I was going to use. Okay, go on.
And, you know, it's just, you know, I love them so much, but I do hold them in a certain place.
Yes.
And I can appreciate, certainly. I mean, the only real negative thing I say is just a little dig at Mick. But, like, look, I bought that blues record. You know, Blue and Lonesome.
Oh, God and, bless. That's good.
And it's like one of the best records I've heard in the last decade. So I do.
Wow, that's neat.
Well, it's a blues record.
Okay.
And, you know, they
are they covers?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm
but it's
get
like
it.
A straight up blues record. It's like it could have been the Stones' first album.
Right.
With the song list they did.
I love hearing that.
And it's so interesting to see a bunch of those guys who started out in earnest as a blues band.
Yes.
Now play the blues straight up.
That's it.
Because it's uniquely theirs, because any idiot can play that music.
Yes.
But the Stones own it as these old guys that have had a whole life.
Yes.
I just want you to know that I do respect the old dudes.
That's awesome. Before you leave, one other thing was, because when I watched that Stones, it did remind me of when Led Zeppelin reunited. I got to be at that concert.
Yeah.
Was it for Ahmet? It was a guy in business. Sorry, I don't know.
Ahmet Ertegun?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they came together. It was...
Was the drummer's kid?
Bonham's son.
Yeah.
Jason.
Yeah.
And I had a friend who's very... the Led Zeppelin 74.
Yeah,
that's
right.
It. Like, don't fuck with me. I don't want to...
See,
okay. But I saw it and I was just... I just was like, I don't give a shit. This is Robert Plant singing. He didn't hit the high notes.
Yeah.
But he hit a lower note. And it's Robert Plant hitting the note. Jimmy Page. There was a cohesion. And the Jason, it was, you're like, okay, touche. Because those are some tough moves.
It was good.
Anyway, I liked it. My friend was not. He was not having it. So I understand.
Well, I think
but I didn't, I wasn't a loyalist at that time. Like, I didn't grow up. I came late.
Well,
I'm Zeppelin.
I remember when I was in high school, like, I'm 56, when In Through the Outdoor came out, which was really the last studio record, I think. And that was, you know, that was in the late 70s, probably, if not 1980.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was still good. But I think the thing with me in terms of my brain is not unlike... Well, you have these guys, you have whatever their work is that meant the most to you. It's sort of mythic, right?
Yes, of course it
is. And like, and it's nice. Well, I went and saw the Stones, like the last tour, I think a couple tours back when I wrote that bit. And it was great. And they were really playing. I was excited.
Yeah, you acknowledge all of
you
that.
You know, and you know, and I loved it. But... And also, a lot of times, the stuff that we're longing for, what we're nostalgic for, it was before our fucking time.
Yeah,
it wasn't even a real memory.
It's not even 100%. Well, it reminds me of when Prince was touring and how he wouldn't play. Remember, because
his
religion. No, but he also his religion. I forgot what it was.
Jehovah's Witness. Yeah,
wouldn't play Little Red Corvette or Darling Nikki. Or he would do these jazzed up versions that fuck with you.
Yeah.
So they tease you. Yeah. You know, it's a tough thing being an artist, because at some point it's good to have a fuck you in you all the time. You don't want to, what am I here to please you?
Sure, yeah.
You know, so so it's a good spirit to have, but as an audience, a greedy little thing. Like, I haven't seen Bob Dylan yet. I don't care.
Never.
There's certain people I haven't, I got to see Tom Petty's last show.
I saw the second to the last one at the Bowl. Was that where it was? At Hollywood Bowl,
I felt those guys fell from the heavens, and it was something next to God. There was top form. If it was any positive, you could say they went out and top.
People love Dylan. I know guys see him all the time. They, you know, he's hit or miss. You know, sometimes he'll hit it. But like, also, it's like he's a guy that's not afraid to age.
Yes.
So like, you know, he probably is on level, but he's not trying to be anything he isn't. I mean, you can hear him. You know, he just seems to want to die at a hotel somewhere after a state fair show. You know, so if that's the way he wants to go, why wouldn't he want to do that?
He's giving you what he is.
Yeah, he's. Where do you live? On the road, man. You know, that's it, right?
Yeah.
And I love that. And I like the old guys. I definitely like the old guys. It's a vulnerability that's tricky. Age forces a vulnerability.
I can see that.
Do you know what I mean? Which is not bad necessarily, but like, you know, having interviewed some of the like Roger Waters or Neil Young, it's just sort of interesting, you know, that they're fragile old dudes, you know.
Yes.
But they are, you know, they are the geniuses. They are the gods. But there they are, just a little angry old man sitting in front of me.
That's it. 100%. I can't believe you interviewed those two. Those are who I want to see as well. While it was young.
Yeah.
And then Roger Waters, I didn't get to see that. The last tour he did, what is it, 2 years ago?
Yeah, they're great. And it was great to talk to him. But then there's also a part of me being sort of the end of the boomer spectrum, where really it's sort of like, when do these guys stop?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, but they're both so vital, and that music is timeless. That's the other thing about music, is it's magical like nothing else. It's like people want to hear that song. Play that song that we know, you know, for our whole life.
Yeah.
You know, sing that song for us.
Well, and as long as it's vital to people, they don't have to stop. And I think it's important. For me, and I know you see this.
I think that's right.
Music is... Like when my dad, he had, not to bring it to this, but he had Parkinson's dementia and couldn't barely was forming sentences. And one of our last fun things was listening to Van Halen's Jump.
Oh, yeah.
And I also took him to a Steely Dan concert. He was all Steely Dan when I was growing up.
Right.
And he, in that time, was not sick. There was no time at that time. There was no
when
sickness.
You're
there was
the
no
music.
Time. You can transcend in the music, and it's just so deep and beautiful. And it's quick, you know, it goes right in.
Right in.
All right.
Nice.
What
ending.
Was this? 9 hours?
About nine.
Jesus.
But it's great. It was a great 9 hours.
I feel it. I mean, I have no place to judge. I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Yeah. I did.
Okay. I did.
Thanks for coming.
Bye.
That was Juliette Lewis.
I love her.
Her series, The Sacred Lies, The Singing Bones, season 2 is now streaming on Facebook Watch. And don't forget to go to podswag.com/WTF or WTFpod.com and click on the merch link. Get yourself some stuff from our new Decade of Domination collection, signed posters, glow-in-the-dark shirts, writing sets with designs by artist Johnny Jones. My Netflix special premieres March 10th. I'll talk to you Thursday. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.